With its abundant natural beauty, charming towns, and friendly people, South Carolina offers the kind of discoveries that stay with you long after you've left. Like the realization you're good at something you never before tried. Or your first oyster roast, and a taste you didn't expect to love. And other times, it just hits. Like the view on a windswept Appalachian mountaintop. So come find the undiscovered you in South Carolina. Visit discoversouthcarolina.com.
The Back Nine Boys Golf Show. All about golf, from putting to driving, from hooks to whatever. Now, here's your host of the Back Nine Boys Golf Show, Rich Stiles.
Good morning and welcome to the show. The Back Nine Boys is brought to you by Bridgestone Golf. Play the Tour B ball with Mindset Technology. By the Club at Sea Ponds. By PXG, you've never played like this before. By RSM, proud sponsor of the RSM Classic, giving back to our community. And by Stitch Golf. Dress your game. And let's not forget CJ's Italian Restaurant, voted best pizza, known for their deep dish and thin crust and much, much more. Check out their full menu at cjsitalianrestaurant.com. Our guest this morning is all about the weather, all over. Bob Dugan with Thorgard. Bob, welcome to the show.
Rich, thank you for having me on.
So Thorgard, for 50 years, has been around talking about and helping golf courses and many other type businesses and companies with the weather. How did it start and why did you start Thorgard?
Well, I didn't start Thorgard. A gentleman named Bob Humphrey started it back in 1973. Most of, well, actually the only lightning indicator that was on the market was a detection network.
Gotcha.
And a lot of the airports, military sites, didn't like the delays. Just because they're running businesses and they need to shut down only when they have to shut down and get back to work early. So the initial customers were airlines like Eastern Airline had us, Air Canada has us throughout Canada. We're still with them and the airports. And then some explosive companies. Through some weird events in my history, I ended up being introduced to Bob, and he had a fantastic fish finder that he wanted me to use. And it was, for me, it was one of the most useful tools I ever had. Then he kept telling me about his lightning prediction system, and I said, you can't predict lightning. You, like myself, probably played through a lot of terrible storms when we were younger.
Oh, yeah.
Not knowing any better.
Right.
Then in 1988, while I was running the Northern Amateur Golf Championship in Chesterton, Indiana, we got to use Thorgard. I didn't want it. I didn't want to use it. I didn't trust it. I didn't believe in it. But Bob was pretty persuasive. I brought it to the tournament. Second round of the tournament, the system predicted a bolt out of the blue that came from a storm 50 miles away. Unfortunately, the skies were absolutely blue, no storms around.
Wow.
So we didn't believe it. So it took us a couple minutes before he started going crazy and says, you have to suspend play. So we did. Nobody was in a hurry to get in, and that strike hit six kids on the 18th fairway.
Oh my gosh.
Nobody got hurt, but it was a wake-up call. And that was the point where I thought to myself, maybe you can predict lightning. And eventually, at the time, I was also working with Gary Loomis, developing the Loomis graphite shafts from the late 80s and the 90s.
Right.
So I had a choice. Go to work for Loomis or go to work for Thorgard. And I visited my old friend Gary Adams, who I'm sure you know from TaylorMade fame. And
oh, yeah.
He was sort of like my mentor and a very good friend for a long time. And basically, I asked him, which one should I do? And he said, go to Thorgard. But if you do, it'll be the most difficult job you ever had in your life. He was right on both counts.
Why was it so difficult? Because trying to tell people that you can predict weather?
That was easy, actually, because the first two major customers we had were the TPC courses and the Marriotts. It gave us some credibility right away.
Right.
But when we added the horn component to the system for audible warnings,
right,
the RF systems were terrible. And I was just, I didn't know enough about electronics to work through that. Eventually, we did get that fixed, but we had to actually design and create our own radios to do it.
Well, don't you find, I mean, I do. I mean, I'm a ranger part-time at Sea Island. And when now with GPS, it's much easier as far as letting players know that something is coming because it comes up on the GPS. But prior to that, you would hear thunder. It would rain a little bit. And you'd say, oh, I could probably play two or three more holes. And that's when the danger happens.
That's right. Before and after a storm are the most dangerous times, because during a storm, when there's a lot of lightning, you tend not to be outside.
Right.
Common sense keeps you in. But in those other situations where there's not close visible lightning or lightning hasn't started yet, you don't know whether it's just rain or something more dangerous is going to happen. So we actually were the first company to provide a lightning warning into a golf cart, and that was with Visage. Originally, GPS Industries and Kevin Carpenter, who I've known forever.
Right.
And Club Car started using it, then EasyGo followed suit, and they do it as well. But you like the redundancy of the horns as well as the notifications on the carts.
Sure, sure. But now it seems with GPS, I mean, it says lightning or whatever, and basically the golf course is closed. It comes up on the GPS. How has GPS helped Thorgard grow, or has it?
I don't think it's really helped us grow, because we've got a very, very strong foundation. We have a lot of customers in all kinds of industries.
Right. And
that base is hopefully always going to continue to grow. But what we do, because we're really a technology company, we look for the best ways possible to provide warning to the people. And I think, you know, I met Fred Palmer at one of our early first tee conventions they had, when both Thorgard and Club Car were early involved people with first tee. We developed a relationship. I got Kevin Carpenter and Fred together, and eventually we were able to get those warnings on the golf cart, which made total sense. And over the years, we've added other parts to our technology, the URL for the new system, the app. So there's a lot of ways to get notified. From our point of view, the more ways somebody can be notified, perhaps the more quickly they'll believe that there's a problem and they'll seek shelter.
Right. When right now, I mean, we're in the midst of a terrible cold weather, snow, ice, obviously for the golf courses, weather becomes an issue sometimes. But Thorgard has the ability to help with the rain, the thunder, the lightning. One of the questions that somebody asked me to ask you was, when there is thunder, how long does lightning take to come after that?
Okay, lightning, you got sound traveling.
Right.
Versus the light traveling. So when you see a lightning strike, every 5 seconds is a mile.
Okay.
But you can have, as happened at the Northern Amateur, you could have a visible storm 10 or 12 or 14 miles away that does not appear to be affecting you. But it's the energy that's created from that storm that creates the lightning. We're just looking at the electricity in the air with a very sophisticated algorithm. So it's 10 miles away, and all of a sudden that field begins building at the golf course. We're tracking that growth, and when it gets to a certain point, that's when we pull the trigger. You also have situations, particularly down here in Florida, and I will say that it is very cold in here today.
Yes, yes.
We're in the early 40s or low 40s yesterday and today, and it's, we don't, you know, I'm from Chicago, but I don't like this. I like a little bit more heat.
I'd understand.
You know, those down here, we get a lot of first strikes from storms that form overhead without any advance notice. And again, it's the electricity that we're monitoring so that we can provide warning before that first strike hits.
So on most of the GPS systems, you are able to hear thunder in the distance. What is your recommendation, or what does Thorgard recommend in there for their golf carts? How close does lightning need to be in order to clear the golf course? Is it a 10-mile radius, or is it 5?
No, we don't detect lightning. We're prediction.
Right, right, right.
So we don't care how far away the lightning is. That's irrelevant in our algorithm.
Okay.
It is the spikes that begin to build up over time.
Okay.
That show that the energy is growing. So we're a time-based system. So if somebody wants 8 to 20 minutes warning, we set the amplifier in the system to work in that area. So with those settings, you probably start taking lightning 3, 4, 5, 6, 7 miles away.
Okay.
But you can have lightning, particularly at the airports that use a very small range, 5-minute warnings. You can have lightning 1.5 miles away. And if the energy isn't on the ramp, they're not shutting down.
Right. It all varies basically from airport to business to golf carts to golf courses and so on.
Yes.
Right. So not only is Thorgard detection, but now it's also protection, obviously.
Well, it's a warning.
Right.
It's an advanced warning system. In the lightning business, lightning protection refers to lightning rods, grounding systems, surge protectors, things of that nature. We don't do any of that.
Well, give us your website so our listeners can go to it, or our golf course owners or superintendents, if they don't have something, which I'm sure most do, but tell us how to find out more.
Yeah, they can go to www.thorgard.com. And then if they want to get a more detailed history of Thorgard, my involvement with Thorgard, our involvement with the USGA, I hate plugging my book, but then go get my book, All I Am.
Please do. Go ahead.
By Robert M. Dugan. It's actually a book that I was directed to write it by Jesus after my wife died. There's a lot in it that people think I was very brave to talk about, because I wasn't a very nice man when I was younger, but that's all part of the story.
You got awesome. Well, Bob, thank you for being with us. I appreciate it. God bless and have a great day. And I hope it gets warmer where you are.
It will in a week after the superintendent show.
You got it. All right. God bless. Take care.
Okay. Thank you very much for your time, Rich.
I'm Brad King, CEO of Stitch Golf, and you're listening to the Back Nine Boys.
We're with Hobart Manley at his house at Isle of Hope. And Hobart, welcome to the Back Nine Boys Golf Show.
Pleasure to be here, Rich.
All right. A lot of people have called you Savannah's greatest golfer. When you hear that, what do you think?
I think that they could be a little off base. But I used to win all the local tournaments, like the Mary Call to Open. I won that 9 times. I mean, everybody talked about that for a long time. But then, the local stuff. And I won the Southern PGA Championship here in Savannah in 1954. And they had a lot of good you know, professor from four states. That's Georgia, Florida, Alabama, and Tennessee.
And you also won the Mid-South up at Pinehurst, which is a pretty prestigious tournament, one that Davis Love has won. That's a great accomplishment as well.
That was considered the best amateur tournament in the country, except the National Amateur, of course. I've got quite a different story for that. I beat Billy Joe Patton in the finals in 1951, and I finished, I was two down going to the 15th hole, and I finished with five straight threes to beat him one up, and one of the holes was a par five. And then a few years later, I was declared a non-amateur for accepting expense money. A couple of people took me over to Europe to play golf a couple of times. And anyway, we got reported, and I lost my amateur status for a couple of years, 2 years.
All right, so you're playing this guy, and you're two down, you're on 15, and you get several threes in a row. What was going through your head? Like, I've got this, I'm going to beat this guy, and you win one up.
Well, of course, he was quite a, you know, accomplished player, but I thought, I got a chance. All I can do is lose. And so I just sort of played on in without thinking about, you know, what score I was going to make. I was just playing him. And anyway, he was a wholesale lumber dealer, and my father had a sawmill here, and we supplied a lot of lumber for the furniture people in North Carolina, the state from which Billy Joe was, lived and played there. And we were talking on the phone one day, in like, it was 1962. And I got a call from Billy Joe. He wanted to buy a couple of carloads of lumber for one of the big furniture companies up there. And we got to talking, and he said, "Well, I'll see you next week at Pinehurst." I said, "No, Billy, I haven't had an invitation there for years." And he said, "Well, I'll fix that." So he arranged for me to have an invite. I got it in about 2 or 3 days later. So I went to my dad and said, "Dad, I just got an invite to go to back to Pinehurst for the North-South." He said, "Well, okay, you know." And so I got to Pinehurst and was playing good. I hadn't played any tournaments to speak of much. And sure enough, I met Billy Joe in the finals again. And he beat me soundly. I think it was like 5-4. So he got his revenge. And I was amazed that I got as far as I did, because I really hadn't prepared at all. I was just gotten married and working at the sawmill. But anyway, it was fun.
Well, you've had quite a career. 6 U.S. amateurs, 3 British amateurs, 2 French amateurs, and 1 Canadian amateur. Right. When you started playing golf, did you think you would have this much success as an amateur?
I don't think so, Rich. It's hard for me to remember that far back.
All right, let me ask you this. Some of the guys that you've played with, let's talk about some of the people that you have played with.
The professional golfers?
Yes, sir.
Well, I can name just a lot of them. They used to play a lot of exhibitions, and I was invited, especially up to Atlanta, the week before the Masters. They had an exhibition out at North Fulton. And I was invited up there about 5 or 6 times to play. I played the first time I played with Jimmy Thompson, and I don't remember the other player. And then we had Sneed was there, Mr. Nelson, who was my favorite golfer, Byron Nelson. And I can't remember, Sam Sneed played a couple of times, Dr. Middlecoff.
And Mr. Hogan?
Not there. The exhibition with Mr. Hogan was in Chattanooga.
And what was he like? You said he was not very talkative.
Not at all. And he was just, I think, mostly interested in getting through the game, collect his money, or which maybe he already had, and, you know, get on about his business. This was a very self-centered person. You're not supposed to talk about your dead people, but he was just really, as they say, all wrapped up in himself.
All right. I want to ask you a couple more questions. You've played with Hogan. You said he was not real friendly. You've played with Sneed. You said he was friendly, just a genuine guy. Tell us about the match that you played at Druid Hills in Atlanta, where you had to play on your knees.
Well, at the end of the afternoon in the competition at the Dogwood Invitational, that's what the name of the tournament was at Druid Hills, a bunch of guys were sitting around talking, having a drink, and golf came up about who did what or something, and somebody said, "Well, Hobart, I've seen you hit a ball off your knees. Have you ever tried playing or something?" Anyway, we were involved in it. Harvey was sitting there, and he said, "I'll play him on his knees, and I'll give him a stroke a hole." And I said, "Well, let's try it." And then a lot of the guys were betting, and, you know, how it would come out. So we played, and I did fairly well, but I three-putted the last hole, and we broke dead even, which was really, I was happy about that. Not the golf outcome, but just the fact that nobody, you know, lost their money betting on me. I didn't like that part.
But that was Harvey Ward that you played with on your knees.
Yes. And say, Harvey and I were good friends and competed against one another, but it was usually all Harvey and seldom myself. But I did beat him a couple of times.
All right, one last story. I heard that you were the one that introduced Arnold Palmer to his first wife, Winnie. Can you tell us about that?
Well, it was up at Fred Waring's place up at Shawnee on Delaware. He had a big tournament there. And one of his associates got me a blind date. And it was with Winnie. And I had never met her or anything, but when arranged the appointed time for our date came, I had recruited Arnold to take my place. And so when she arrived, you know, I said, "Well, Harvey, there's your date." And so he went over and, you know, he introduced himself. I didn't actually go with him. I slipped out the other door and was gone.
And the rest is history. They ended up getting married for quite a while.
They surely did. They were married within about 6 months. He had just won the National Amateur in Detroit.
Now, you also played in 3 U.S. Opens. All won, ironically enough, by Ben Hogan.
True.
You missed the cuts, but you got to play in 3 U.S. Opens.
That's correct. And wonderful golf courses. Oakmont, Marion, and the famous course in just west of Los Angeles.
Riviera.
Riviera, yes. And that was really the first big tournament I played in.
Out of all the golf that you've played, all the people that you've played, all the amateur tournaments that you've won, is there one thing about the game of golf that stands out for you?
That's a hard question. I think to start, it was a getaway, to get away from the sawmill. And of course, I got married, I got married in 1956. And so I had to go to work, and the golf became secondary, but I still could sneak off every now and then when my dad was in a good mood and would help me financially.
Hi, this is Brent Clements from Honma Golf, and you're listening to the Back Nine Boys.
Okay, we're with Phil Kenyon, Director of Putting here at Sea Island Resort. And Phil, welcome to the Back Nine Boys Golf Show.
Yeah, cheers. Good to be here.
It's good to be anywhere at this point, isn't it? All right, let's talk a little bit about putting. What are the three things that you think most good putters have got to have?
They get the ball in the hole is the obvious statement, isn't it? And to do that, you've got to be able to control your start line. You've got to be able to pick the right read, and then, you know, obviously then you've got to be able to match the speed. So they have the skill to be able to match those three components. You'll find that good putters will use a variety of different techniques to develop those skills, but ultimately it's a skill set and matching those three things.
I've seen a lot of the guys on the tour, on the practice greens, work more on speed, not necessarily on trying to get it in the hole, but trying to get it to the hole or to the edge of the green on the fringe, just to begin to work on their speed prior to them playing.
Yeah, I mean, I think the higher the level that you go, the sort of more refined the things that these guys are working on. So a lot of the time they'll have good sort of technique and their ability to control start line, you know, that they've got down. So it's the more finer elements of, you know, controlling the speed and obviously green reading that they could be working on. You know, if you're a little bit out with your speed and you've got, you know, a perfect line, then the ball's not going to go in. So, small adjustments, but can have a big impact.
How long does it take for you to work with someone, let's talk about amateurs rather than the pros, to begin to read greens better than they have been? There have been times when you've seen a putt that looks like it breaks right, and you're giving it too much room to break right, and it doesn't. So how do you begin to help someone read greens better?
Well, there are different techniques that you could use to help that player. Sometimes a lot of green reading or poor green reading can be down to other factors, such as they have a particular start line bias or a particular bias of how they control their speed, which then influences their green reading. So depending on what method you want to try and use with a player, whether it's, you know, incorporating something like aim point or whether you're trying to use more traditional methods, you're basically going down to the basics of what determines how much a ball breaks, you know, the slope, the gradient, angle that you're putting across, and, you know, working around that. But sometimes you have to also then remove some of these other biases that could be influencing the player's decision making when it comes to the green reading.
When you work with someone and they're plumb bobbing or they're using the aim point, is there one particular one that you prefer over another, or does it matter as long as the ball is going into the hole or close to it?
Well, I think, you know, you're right in a sense, whichever method works for the player. I mean, plumb bobbing for me isn't a method that works. I don't think there's any scientific validity to show how that works. There are lots of players who don't sort of work well with aim point, who kind of like to use more feel and visuals, who aren't very good at sort of sensing slope with their feet. So the main thing is matching a method to what the player can do and what the player can work with and develop, and then ultimately it's matching a method that they can work with but also then helps them hold more putts.
Now, we've seen a lot of pros out there that we watch on the weekends who struggle with their putting. Obviously puts more pressure on the rest of their game, the drives, the irons, and so on. Tommy Fleetwood, a lot of people will say he should be winning more than he is. So you work with him. Is putting become an issue, or is it something other in his game?
I think he... This year, we're in a new season now, aren't we? But like in terms of a calendar year, he's not had his best year. I think he finished, he technically kind of lost his card at the end of the 21 season in America. I mean, actually, he's had some good performances in Europe, but probably not his best year by his own admission. And if you look, you know, statistically, he's not sort of played as well across the whole board, really. I don't think you can pinpoint one area. But when you look at him, obviously spending time with him and being close to him, he's actually not been that far away, you know, practicing well. It's just not translated into stuff on course, and you know, a lot of times that can be down to confidence or just small margins. I know he's not driven the ball as well as he normally does, but it only takes one errant drive per round, which he can be penalised for, and the level is so it's so tight, isn't it, at the top level? Then all it takes is a bad shot here or there, and it makes a significant difference. So. Yeah, I mean, he's working hard on all areas of his game, whether it be his putting, his long game, short game. I mean, I think actually short game was probably his best area. This, you know, in and around the green was his best area and a much improved area in recent years. So I don't think he's too far away. He's had a cup, you know, he had a top 10 last week at Zozo, and played well in parts in Vegas. So I don't think he'd be far away from, you know, coming back and contending at the right end of the leaderboard.
When you work with someone, I've seen a lot of people, Matsuyama uses different lengths. He has to make three consecutive putts. He has a pretty regime around his putting game. I find sometimes when I play that I putt better when the putts are far away, long putts, than I do with short putts.
Yeah.
Because I don't think I concentrate as much on direction. I'm just trying to get it to the hole. On a short putt, so I'm saying, is it going to break left? Is it going to break right? Do a lot of golfers that you work with have issues with confidence with shorter putts rather than longer putts? Or would I just be an oddball? You can be honest.
Yeah, I mean, I think we all know that you're an oddball. I think it depends from player to player. You know, the players will have certain strengths and weaknesses even within the putting game alone, like they would across the whole board. And some players could be particularly good inside of 5 feet and maybe not so good 5 to 10 feet. And then really good from 20 feet. I think sometimes, you know, there's a lot more luck involved outside of 20 feet. And but I think like that 5 to 20 feet area is a critical area where your skill really can define your performance. And I think, you know, we're quite close to the hole, in maybe inside 10 feet, could be a little bit more emphasis on certain components of putting, like your ability to start your ball online. And as you get a bit further away, you know, speed, reading has a little bit more of an influence. So players will have patterns where they're good at certain things, certain distances, and not at others. Now, ultimately, you've got to work on all of those distances and work on things which are going to help you be successful across all of those distances. And that's, you know, where like coaches can help players, because sometimes they're not always aware of that themselves. And it could be easy to shy away from practicing things,
right?
You know, where you've got to face that and get better at it you know, that's how I would look at that.
Do you think sometimes the pros and even amateurs take for granted the short putts like they're going to make them and therefore don't go through the regular routine or the confidence that they should have in their head prior to that putting?
I mean, this is a slightly kind of different answer to the question that you've asked, but I think on average, I would say the average golfer underappreciates how good putters are inside 10 feet. So if you're looking at tour players, how high they convert, you know, the average would be about 90% conversion inside 10 feet. And then they overestimate how many longer putts that they would hold. You know, on a regular PGA tournament, on average, the average PGA professional would hold 5 putts outside of 10 feet during the 72-hole tournament, which a lot of people would overestimate. That, right. You know, often if I ask that question, they'll guess, you know, 10, 15 putts or whatever. So I think there's like a bias, you know, in terms of the perception of how difficult or how easy certain distances are. And most amateur golfers can get better inside 10 feet. That's going to have a significant impact on their score. And primarily it's determined by skill. You know, if you look at the best players in that area, they tend to be the same each week or each month or each year. And the reason it's the same people is that they're the ones that have the most skill. If you look at outside of 20 feet, then it's more random as to who right. the best is. And it's random because there's a bit more luck involved. It's a bit like the right. lottery, isn't it? So, yeah, like, I think people don't realise how important 4, 5, 6 foot putts are. And if you could go and practice one area and get better at it, it would be inside 10 feet. If you can become a world-class putter inside 10 feet, then you're going to be okay, irrespective of what happens outside.
We're with Patrick Richardson, the director of golf at the Watersound Club in Panama City Beach, Florida. Patrick, welcome to the show.
Thank you. Glad to have you here. A little six-hour drive and a different time zone, so you're making a big effort.
You got that. All right, so talk to me about the three golf courses that you've got here at Watersound Club.
Yeah, so Watersound Club's got 54 holes, Shark's Tooth, Camp Creek, and our new golf course, the third. So all three uniquely designed by Camp Creek, so Tom Fazio design. Shark's Tooth is a Greg Norman design, and the third was designed by a Golden Isles favorite, Davis Love the third.
All right, so how do each course play differently? Fazio, we know, has always done things. I mean, he did Seaside. He's done an unbelievable amount of golf courses, Reynolds, Lake Oconee, and so on. Tell me a little bit about how each one of them plays.
Yeah, so you know, obviously you nailed it with the Fazio design. I always say the fairway bunkers give it away who designs a golf course. He's that's his specialty, in my opinion, but really cool. Fantastic layout at Camp Creek. Norman came in and used his experience of that Australian kind of feel to it. So it has a little bit of a links design, but it also has some water on it. Not as much as Camp Creek. Camp Creek has a few lakes, but and then Davis came in and with Mark and Scott Sherman, and just came in and said, "Hey, we want to do something really fun and have a more of a definitely a links style golf course." And here we are out here today, and you're getting your first look at it, and it shows it's a links golf course. And so all three have a unique flavor to them, and which is great for our membership and those staying at Camp Creek Inn.
All right, I have to wonder, the third Davis Love, the third, this is your third golf course that you've put on the property. Were those coincidences, or was that kind of in the plan all along?
That's a great question. So we at the table were just referred to the new golf courses, the third golf course, with no intent of calling it that. I can kind of remember the scroll, if you will, of names going down a list, and some of them are really cool names, right? And we kept kind of going back and forth, and you know, I think the conversation kind of went more like, hey, we want to show our appreciation to Davis, you know, not only here but for the game of golf, and no one's taking the time to name a golf course after him. So we kind of thought this was the right time to do that. So that's where we landed with being our third golf course and Davis Love the third designing, it was an easy decision.
I love it. I just think that is so cool. So watersoundclub.com, is that the website?
That's correct.
All right. And how many members do you have, and which course gets the most play?
Well, you know, we have 3,500 member accounts. It's a big club, national membership, if you will. Maybe 40% live here locally. So for the listeners in the Golden Isles, it's very similar to a Sea Island model. And Camp Creeks are by far our golf course gets more plays. More of our residents live near that golf course. But so in Church Youth and the third are, you know, they're behind, but not too far behind.
And what comments have you heard about the third from your members and guests that have come in to play it?
They just love that we didn't cookie cut it, that it's not the same as the other two, that we allowed Davis and his team to come in with an open playbook, really, and paint the picture for us. And it's unique in one way as well as 9 and 10 are about as far away from the clubhouse. It's not really a turn. I was giving Rich a little bit of a riddle earlier, but we're sitting here right now near the 8th green. It's turning to number 9 tee, if you will. And Shark Tooth, we had the Shark Shack, and we kind of couldn't figure out what to name our turn house on the third, but we determined it. Why not call it the Love Shack? So that's where we landed with. And so we've had some fun with some names, and I'm sure we'll come up with some other names on some of these holes as we get more familiar with it.
Well, as we've been driving around, you said that the University of Alabama was here, their golf team with Coach Jay. That's got to be cool, because you being somewhat of an Alabama fan, that's got to be cool for you.
I don't think anybody would say I'm a somewhat fan.
I know. I was being.
I definitely bleed some crimson. But Jay and I have been friends for a few years, and obviously got to know him really well when I was at Sea Island and the SEC Championship. And so we've bonded a really good friendship. And the team's first time being out here, seeing the golf course the last couple of days. And they felt like they were at home in Tuscaloosa, which I thought was kind of cool. But Davis and Mark and Scott did some work in Tuscaloosa for the golf team there as well. And so the green complexes are very similar. So that it was kind of cool to hear them feel like they're, even though they're, you know, 5 hours away, they felt like they were at home.
Davis's son went to school at Alabama. Also played on the golf team.
That's right. Drew did. Sure did.
Yeah, he did. All right. So watersoundclub.com is where you need to go. And you need to find out about these three golf courses, because they are very unique, very playable. How many different tees do you have as far as different skill levels?
Yeah, Camp Creek and Shark Tooth have 5 sets of tees. We do some hybrid models, if you will, combo tees. And then the third has 6 sets of tees. So we have a lot of tee markers. And one thing we do unique at the third, I probably should have pointed this out earlier to you, we only place 1 tee marker for each color on the tee markers and on the tee boxes. So it gives players the option to go left or right of the tee marker as far as they want to. If they have someone that wants to hit more of a fade or a draw, they can do that. So it's a little bit different concept. We just didn't want to say, hey, let's just do what we normally do with the other golf courses. So that was one thing we did different.
Very different. Never played a course with only 1 tee marker. That's an interesting concept. All right. So we've talked about the watersoundclub.com. That's where you need to go to find out about these 3 golf courses. But you just came back from the PGA show, and a lot of people go to that, like 30,000 attendees. You got 1,000 people with different booths. What did you find? And I know you were doing classes down there and stuff, but what did you find that was kind of unique that kind of caught your attention?
I think the one key thing I was noticing was the big companies kind of pressing the reset button a little bit on the apparel side of the equation, and knowing that, hey, they can't rest on your laurels, right, of who we are. And so I think that was really a kind of a take home and realize that, hey, they're not giving in to their success. They want to see more. Technology-wise, I spent some time with Ben Blaylock and our director of instruction over at Camp Creek, and you know, looking at different technology with TrackMan, and you know, just kind of coming up with concepts for putting labs and things in that nature. So it was really fun, and it's obviously, you know, time to reconnect with old friends and network and get to hear really good, you know, like you mentioned earlier, going to some seminars and classes and hearing about success stories with, if it comes to tournament experiences, to day-to-day operations. So it's a good time to kind of know that, hey, that's a kickoff for the year, and we're looking forward to a great 26.
Well, Patrick, I appreciate the time. Appreciate the tour. This was fun.
Glad to have you, and we'll hope to have you back soon.
Hello, America. It's your new favorite podcast here.
Yes, it's James and Andy, two-fourths of the British podcast, No Such Thing as a Fish.
That's right. We do facts. We do weird facts, fun facts, facts you've never heard before. James, give us a fact.
Did you know you may be able to cure chronically blocked noses with a snot transplant?
Lovely, lovely facts.
If you want to hear us, go to wherever you get your podcasts and search for No Such Thing as a Fish.
That's right. We'll see you there.